in here or not. But, you know.
Well, I think there has to be a way to fight this. It's sort of people use our World Common Board clearly said no more.
Good morning. We are going to begin the third meeting of the Bridging the Health Continuum Working Group for the Healthcare Access Commission. Today is October 2nd. Welcome. I think we'll begin with some introductions of some members who have joined us for the first time today. And for those of you who are here for the first time, would you introduce yourself? We can start over with Bob.
Good morning. I'm Bob Meyer. I'm the Human Service Director in Blue Earth County.
Thank you very much, Bob. Is there any other new?
Gail Helene with Evercare.
Deborah Sherman, Mental Health Director for Access Healthcare and Clinical Director at Emily Program.
Okay, I think we'll just suspend further introductions then, unless the new members, maybe I better run around because there are new members who don't know the old members. Let's, Bob, we'll start right, we'll just move right on around.
Old Todd Munson.
Old Todd.
Wendy Thompson, Director, Kennebec County Public Health and Human Services.
Glenn Andes, Medica Health Plans.
Jan Malcolm, Courage Center.
Gail Kvenvold, Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance.
Representative Paul Thiessen.
Representative Larry Hosh.
Senator Kathy Charon.
David Giel, Senate Research Staff to the work group.
Patty Cullen, Care Providers of Minnesota.
Michael Skandrett with Howland Consulting, and we're providing staff to the group.
Emily Zilla, also with Howland.
Okay, great. Well, what I learned from our last meeting is that this time goes by very quickly and that it's very hard to stay within the time frame. So I am going to try to be a little more of a taskmaster this time, but not so much that what I'm hoping for when we organize the agenda was that we would give enough time for us as a committee to have some interaction, some discussion going on. As you remember at the last meeting, I suggested and you all agreed that we put something together in writing that we could begin to react to in terms of suggestions that will move us towards achieving the goal of this committee, and that's what we will be doing and spending substantial time on this morning. But before we get to that, we are going to have an update, as was requested, on the various subcommittees of the Healthcare Access Commission, and I'm going to turn that over to David Giel to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, you should have a handout landscape format titled The Status of the Other Work Groups and of the Transformation Task Force. I consulted a staff person from each of these groups, and this is the information that I was given. The first group is identifying healthcare cost savings. In a 9/13/07 progress report, the chairs of this group stated that the most promising method to reduce healthcare costs would be to expand the use of the medical home model. And they came up with some, I guess, relatively soft savings of as high as $2.8 billion based on Mayo Clinic experience. And they've been meeting with the private sector analysts and DHS to develop a firm fiscal note on this concept. And this group is also focused on care coordination for chronic complex health conditions, regulatory changes that would make it easier to provide care in rural and underserved areas, and to ensure adequate primary care staff for medical homes. And they're in the process of developing a formal set of recommendations. The next work group is public health, and they're discussing obesity prevention, chronic disease prevention, and non-financial barriers to prevention services. They've had presentations on those topics, and they have not adopted any recommendations, but their plan is to review final recommendations on October 22nd. The next group is healthcare for long-term care workers. Their scope is to utilize the medical assistance funds to provide health insurance for long-term care workers. They had one meeting, and they decided to conduct a survey of long-term care employers regarding health insurance, whether they offer it, the cost, and the take-up rate. And those survey results are going to be discussed at their meeting tomorrow. They've not adopted any recommendations. The Development of New Cost Containment Strategies Group has held 3 meetings. Their topics have included the Health Department's Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Plan, innovations in communities around the state, autism, prostate cancer screening, wound care, and pay for value. And they also have not adopted any recommendations, and they plan to do that in their meetings October 17 and 31. The single payer health care group has been discussing the cost of the existing health care system, examining other single payer models, and reviewing studies of the cost of converting to a single payer in Minnesota. And they've decided not to prepare a formal fiscal note on single payer, and instead the report is going to discuss the impact of single payer as a whole. The next group, Restructure the Healthcare System Through Identified Savings Work Group. They've held 4 meetings. Their topics have included groups not eligible for current programs, information on anticipated savings due to administrative uniformity and pay for performance, DHS performance measurement and quality improvement, other states' definition of affordability, elimination of payment for unnecessary services, and pay for performance benefits and savings in the business sector. They've discussed extensively the definition of affordable for Minnesota, but again, no recommendations have been adopted. Insurance Market Reform Group has been engaged in an educational process and has recently been discussing individual members' perspectives. One topic of discussion has been the individual mandate. No recommendations have been adopted. Turning to the governor's healthcare transformation task force, they've conducted 3 meetings. First one was organizational, also had an overview of the state healthcare system, and then discussion of future topics. Their second meeting, they focused on chronic illness topics. The third meeting, they discussed transforming the healthcare payment system and creating systems to reduce the prevalence of chronic illness. They've got a number of additional meetings scheduled, the final meeting being in January 7th next year, and they have not adopted any recommendations to date.
Thank you. Is there anything that...
Dave, just one question. As I was thinking about what you said, reading, it seemed like they covered equity and value and system things. And there was for a while in the 90s, and I don't know, maybe early part of this century, talk about either patient-centered or consumer-controlled, and it could be taken in the sense of reducing costs. In other words, someone coming at it saying the way to manage pain is there are ways that you look more to the consumer. And I don't mean just self-directed. There was some work done in the state of Washington. Has anyone in all of these talked about that?
We had used consumer incentives as part of the healthcare commission under Governor Arne Carlson and had developed some recommendations around that.
And I didn't hear any of that as you were talking. It seemed like there was discussion of system issues and all, but I just didn't hear anything about the role of the consumers in it, whether it's about money or behavior or pain.
Madam Chair, Todd, I'm not sure that this list is definitive, that includes everything they've talked about, so I wouldn't want to say for sure that they have not talked about that. It didn't come up when I was gathering this information.
Thank you, Todd. Are there any other questions? Well, thank you very much. We'll move now to our next item on the agenda, which is the presentations from the Department of Human Services and Health. Who will be going first? Will Pam or? We're going to begin with, I'll have you introduce yourselves and identify what your focus will be. We're going to have one presentation, but two sections to that. And I very much appreciate your coming again today to do this. For those of you who were not here last time, we ran over on our schedule and had asked you to come back, and you graciously did that. So thank you very much. I look forward to your presentation, and I hope that we're able to stay within our time frame. If I interrupt you, it's because I am watching the time, and then we can get further comments online in writing or further discussions outside of the meeting, which I know you've already communicated you'd be available too. So with that, we'll just proceed. Please introduce yourselves.
My name is Jean Wood. I'm with the Aging and Adult Services Division at the Department of Human Services.
My name is Alex Bartolik. I'm the Director of the Disability Services and HIV Divisions at the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
I'm Pam Parker, and I'm Manager of Special Needs Purchasing in the healthcare area at DHS.
Madam Chair and work group members, thank you for the opportunity to come and present on barriers to integration for long-term support services and some initiatives that DHS is working on. The first part of this presentation will cover the work that DHS is doing in long-term care support services across all populations, disabled and elderly, public and private pay, across purchasing strategies, fee-for-service and managed care, and, of course, across the state. And the second part will be an overview of the waivers.
Excuse me. Is it this? Will we be using this?
Yes.
Handout. So for those of you who are looking through your materials, it will be this handout. Thank you.
Thank you. Because people's medical needs and challenges don't end when they exit the clinic door, but just start, coordination with the primary medical system is vital, particularly for those with multiple chronic conditions. We also understand it's important to prevent people from falling into the public safety net for both state financial and people reasons. Minnesota, not unlike other states, faces challenges or barriers. Some of them are opportunities, but they will have costs. A shrinking workforce to provide services, public or private pay, is one of the things that we are forecasting. A changing context of employment, an aging population that will work later in life but may work fewer hours, and where persons with disabilities will have meaningful employment. Also, the need for people to have on-time, quality, and objective information about public and private pay support services is something that was mentioned here last week, and again, we see this as a need or a barrier. The increased use of technology that can extend the shrinking workforce in providing long-term care supports, again, while an opportunity, is also a barrier. Securing affordable and accessible housing options, be it by maintaining current housing stock and making it useful for older people and persons with disabilities through adaptations or providing new housing. Building communities that will have a robust support services to serve its citizens made more important as the baby boomers age. And much of this work, particularly for the aging, has been validated through our work with Transform 2010, which, of course, is a look at the needs of state agencies and communities as the baby boomers age. What matters to people, however, are outcomes, and they include community membership, health and safety, their own place to live, important long-term relationships, control over the supports that they do want, and employment earnings and stable income. Helping people to help themselves. People really need objective information on time to help them make decisions. And Minnesota has in place services such as the Linkage Lines, MinnesotaHelp.info database, and long-term care consultation. And they provide information on both public and private pay services. These services in the past years have provided information by telephone, in person, through web-based database, through decision-making tools, and in print to 185,000 people. People, their families, informal caregivers need quality and objective information when they discover they need it. It has to be accessible, friendly, provide skilled personnel to help people navigate a complex system of payers and providers. But the system remains fragmented with people falling through the cracks because they don't know where to go and become frustrated. And the need for navigators in parts of our system have also been discussed. Future demand says that information assistance services must be better coordinated, building on the strengths of each existing service so that they are reliable places to access information in community locations. And they need to be linked to a comprehensive assessment and report cards on the quality of services available. DHS is currently conducting a long-term care services study authorized by the legislature this past session, and will study more thoroughly how people are making decisions about their long-term care. One of the things that we've also been talking about is perhaps it is time to work on some further demonstrations, building on the strengths that each of these services have. Effective support services can be low-tech, not necessarily medical, relatively inexpensive, and still critical in people's lives. Building services provides an infrastructure of reliable providers available regardless of source of payment or population served. In this development process, DHS has used a gaps analysis to gauge service needs county by county. This year, the gaps analysis will expand beyond aging services to include measuring services for persons with disabilities. Based on that gaps analysis, we have used community service development grants to fund communities and providers to expand the availability of services or to integrate the increased use of technology into services. Using elder care development partnerships and the area agencies on aging to foster the spreading of promising practices for support services. Community service development grants, along with some federal funds, have built services in areas such as coordinated transportation, remodeled nursing facilities so they can provide assisted living or adult day services, strengthened and broadened health promotion efforts for those with chronic health conditions, particularly in the prevention of falls, and early identification and support of people with dementia, which again builds on chronic disease management models. The development process involves profits, nonprofits, and communities of faith. No one can be excluded because we need everyone involved in the coming years. In addition, systems development and maintenance has changed for public pay services. In the past, counties have had the responsibility to recruit providers, negotiate contracts, and monitor those contracts. But with the entrance of managed care into that field, I think it has become quite confusing to all concerned about who has the responsibility for the development of those services contracts and of that services network. It's clearly time for DHS, counties, and health plans to clarify roles and to develop some agreements about contract development. Supporting family caregivers is also an important area, particularly in the era of shrinking workforce. With 92% of all caregiving provided by families and friends, Minnesota cannot afford to have caregivers burn out or become frustrated. For every 1% of caregivers who give up providing care, it costs the state of Minnesota about $30 million. So we need to support caregivers so they can provide quality care.
And Chair and members, we know that people often don't know where to go to get the help that they need when they need it. And Jean mentioned the role of long-term care consultation in helping people understand what options can be available for them. We have been going through a process of developing a comprehensive assessment that can look at people's strengths, their needs, what their families bring to the table, what's available in their communities to identify where the gaps are and offer better opportunities to look at how best to meet them. This new process is going to improve the decision-making, give better access to services, and provide greater accountability. It's going to be useful for people whether or not they rely on public dollars right now. A lot of people need help making good decisions about what to buy before they're on Medicaid so that they can use their own resources better and tap into their communities, delay or prevent their use of Medicaid and public resources, and when they do need it, to be streamlined, have streamlined access into that. This comprehensive assessment is going to replace three separate assessment and eligibility processes. It's going to be an important tool to shape informed decisions, whether or not public funds will pay for it. People are only going to have to tell their story once, and with the use of this web-based tool, we can link to information about other services that they are receiving in eligibility. At this point, we've piloted the assessment tool, We've piloted it with counties and with health plans in different parts of the state, and our next steps are to analyze the policy implications of implementing it and to develop the technology to support the process. In the future, this holds the potential for an electronic case file that can be the beginning of a case management and more expansive system where people can have access to information about what people are receiving and what their needs are. It will be a rich source of quality and outcome data that will surpass what we have currently. And this good assessment data in the future could be used as the basis for determinations about benefits and resource levels. As John mentioned last week, there are differences between the waiver programs, and the more we can focus on people's functional needs and not their diagnosis, it will help us better meet their needs. Right now, the dollars that people have access to are based on their level of care determination or their eligibility for one of five different medical assistance waiver programs or other state programs. I'm going to do a brief overview of some of the waiver programs based on the questions. I know you've had other information that's been available in your handouts, so we can answer questions later if you have it. But each one of these waivers started at a different point in time to serve
Representative.
Can I just ask one question to back up on the long-term care consultation? You kind of referred to the policy implications of that. What does that mean?
Well, as people have been testing it, some of the questions that have come up is, who's going to do the assessment? What are the qualifications? If you're looking
And does that, if I could ask a
Yes,
question. Does that mean, is it going to be someone at the county level, or is it going to be at the state, between county and state, or is it the training of the person that does the assessment?
That's a good question. It's around the training, but also the qualifications. Right now, some of the assessments, for example, a home care assessment to look at PCA eligibility is required to be completed by a public health nurse, regardless of who employs them. A social worker can do an assessment for a person to look at their eligibility for the developmental disabilities waiver. So if we're consolidating all the assessment criteria, we have to look at who should go out, and it may be a matter of just training and offering opportunities. Some of the other questions are going to be, as we look at what people are eligible for, how do you incorporate all of the state plan programs? Do we look at eligibility in a different way in the future? We're hearing from the people who've been testing at their questions. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Excuse us. Go ahead.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Are you okay with taking questions as you move along?
That's just fine. Okay. This is to help you. In the different programs, the five different waivers, they did start at different times, different advocacy to serve different populations. As a result, there are differences in the kinds of services and the amount of money that's there. And as we go through, we are taking steps to try to alleviate some of those differences. But first, to explain where we are today. The developmental disability waiver serves people with developmental disabilities, meaning they have mental retardation or a related condition. The counties manage this program's dollars. They determine eligibility. They look at how many people are awaiting services and what's going to be the criteria for helping people access it. There is a waiting list. Counties get a budget based on the number of people that they've been serving and some other characteristics that they have to manage within. They are responsible for meeting people's changing needs. So they usually, some of that's predictable, and so they do have to have a certain amount of dollars available in their budget to respond to different situations that arise. If a caregiver should no longer be able to take care of someone and they need to move out of a family home, someone's aging, someone's graduating from high school and now would like to work, they need to be able to pay for those. Counties may not spend more than the money that's given to them. If they do, they are liable for the cost of those services that exceed their allocation. For a number of years, we haven't had growth in this program, so counties had to manage. They could serve more people or fewer people as long as they were within the dollar amount. We now have the ability to have new dollars go in when people go into the program. This is the only program right now that has a waiting list. to this extent at the current time. The next program, if we're following the grid that's in the handout, is the elderly waiver. It's an alternative for people who are at risk of nursing home and are 65 years or older. The level of care is different. For the developmental disabilities, it's looking at people who have a need for habilitation. You're teaching them and helping them to be involved in the community. It's more than just taking care of them from the historical basis. The elderly waiver is an alternative for people in a nursing home. It eligibility looks at their need for nursing home level of care, and it results in a case mix. And an individual may not spend more than their individual case mix. For the developmental disabilities waiver, the county manages the average and determine how much an individual is going to receive. So that's one of the differences. There is an alternative.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. On the developmental disabilities waiver, so the person has to qualify for medical assistance.
Correct.
And can't spend more than they would. Well, and what you're saying there is that they. So that person can't spend more than they would spend in the medical assistance program? Is that an average? Explain that a little more.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay. The waivers are different, and actually the elderly waiver and alternative care, the two programs that are specifically for people who are 65 and older, use a case mix. That particular
person, would you explain case mix?
It is a way of determining how much support would be needed for them, a level of care that corresponds to a different dollar amount. It was originally used in the nursing homes. The nursing homes have moved to a different payment methodology, but the waivers still use that.
And if I could just follow up on that?
Yes, Representative.
So what that means is that in those two programs, the dollars are actually individual compared to what the MA payment would be.
Correct.
Which is different than the other ones.
Well,
go. You can keep going then. I'm sorry.
It's the waiver payment.
Is the
for,
payment.
But it, they cannot spend more
That's
than
what
would otherwise be spent for them in a nursing home.
That's right.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The disability waivers, on differing, they have different methodologies, but the four disability waivers, one for people with developmental disabilities, one serves people with a traumatic brain injury, who would otherwise be at risk of a nursing home or a neurobehavioral hospital, one for people who are at risk of a nursing home because of a disability who are younger, and one for people who have chronic conditions and would be at risk of frequent or prolonged hospitalizations. Those programs operate with the use of an average. So the counties are responsible for managing a pool of dollars to serve people. The developmental disabilities waiver has had a waiting list. The pool has not grown. The other programs, while at times there's been some limits on the rate of growth, if new people go into those programs, the county gets additional dollars to serve them. The counties make the decision on how to allocate dollars to an individual. And there could be someone who uses a very high level of service compared to what it might have cost in a nursing home. It keeps them at home. The counties can individualize it based on the services and other supports that individuals receive.
And if I could do one more follow-up on that. Do we have any information about, so the counties can manage that, mm-hmm. about the per-person cost, I suppose, for people in the waiver programs versus people not in the waiver programs? That makes sense.
Yes. For the waiver programs, we have cost on the comparison between people who are on a waiver and what the cost would have been if they were in that institutional alternative. And I believe one of the handouts given earlier, I think it was last week, has a comparison, and we can make sure that you have that. It looks at each waiver, their level of care, meaning is it nursing home, ICFMR, or a hospital, and it compares the waiver cost with acute care and then the institutional costs and acute care. And we can make sure you get another copy of it. It's a grid that has shaded lines on it.
Can you just tell me what the conclusion was?
That it is far less expensive to receive waiver services.
I got it. Okay. Thank you. Sorry. Mm-hmm. I was not here last week, so I apologize.
I think for the purposes of time, I'm going to keep moving on, we'd be happy to answer any specific questions about the waivers, but you do have some information about the costs and number of people. But some of the barriers that have been raised around the waivers really focus on the things that are different or that are administratively complex as we've looked at the waiver programs. And there are differences. On the other hand, these waiver programs have transformed our system over the past 25 years from one where people only had a choice of staying at home without services or living in large institutions, now to a system where we have home and community-based options across our state, and most people are able to live at home and don't even consider going into a different kind of setting. Despite the differences, there are commonalities. CMS, which is the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that give us the guidelines we have to meet, have been working with national associations in order to come up with a quality framework that has changed how states apply for these waiver programs. It's gone from being primarily focused on cost effectiveness and some of the process to really having to show that we are meeting outcomes for individuals, and all the waivers have to show the same outcomes. We have to show that people have access to services, that there is a process where there is a person-centered planning and delivery system, where there are providers to serve people, that we have an adequate and robust provider capacity and capability to serve unique needs, that there are safeguards for the people on the program, that people have rights and responsibilities that are assured through our systems, that there are outcomes and we can measure satisfaction, and that our system is performing effectively. Last week, there were some questions about how can people get the right service, that it was kind of confusing and it depended on which waiver and trying to waiver shop. And we are taking some strides in activities such as doing a comprehensive assessment and looking at how to streamline the services that are available and consumer-directed options that will help people quite a bit. We are hoping we can get closer to giving people resources and services based on what they need and what's going to help them the most. It is possible to have one consolidated waiver where everything is just in one waiver. However, there will be a cost in order to allocate resources equitably within one waiver without the differences, unless we're going to reduce services to some populations.
Excuse me. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple questions, quickly, hopefully. What is the waiting list on the MRRC waiver right now?
Approximately
400.
I think it is about 1,500, but I can get back to you with the details.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With that waiting list, I know this was one thing that we really worked hard on trying to expand it during the last legislative session, but due to fiscal constraints, we couldn't. But with the cost savings, as indicated here, why do we see such a substantial fiscal note when we address trying to reduce that waiting list, even though we know where the costs are if they're in an institutional setting?
Right now, the main reason is that many people are not living in an ICFMR, for example, with the DD waiver, and we don't have growth in that. So people are relying on what they can get through their families or school systems or using services such as personal care attendant services through the state plan. Because they're not in an institution, it's less expensive than it would be if they were. But
so,
not
so if I heard you correctly, you're saying that the need for the waivers are people that are already are not on a program that's being funded.
Correct.
So they aren't costing the state anything.
Correct.
But they have needs, and they're stumbling along trying to pull together a support program, utilizing their own family members, their own resources. But they are asking for some relief.
Now, some of them may be receiving some of the state plan services, but in the long run, those aren't going to be the correct services to help them get employed or to live on their own.
But they might be receiving some services that could be calculated as a cost saving when we're doing a fiscal note?
It would be part of a current cost, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. Representative Hosh, and then Representative Thiessen, did you have another question?
Maybe not, depending on his question.
Just one last request for maybe future information. Of those on the waiting list, what is their current? Do we have information of what their current situation is? How many are in institutional settings? How many are being supported by family caregivers?
We will get you that information.
Thank you.
We're winding down on our time for this portion of the presentation. Okay. How much time are you thinking you need?
Well, we'll just go quickly to say, one, we are trying to streamline the services. We are looking at services that are unique to any one waiver, and we are making sure if those are useful services that we're including them across all waivers. We also are looking at the residential services, the combination of services that are available through all the different services to support people in their residences or with day and employment. And we are looking at what is it that we really need to offer and redefining those services, streamlining the provider qualifications, and looking at indicators. That will go part of the way at addressing barriers people have in getting the right service. We also are expanding self-directed options. So we do have ways within the waiver for people to be able to purchase and direct their own services. We are in the process of developing an option that's called the 1915J that will give people an alternative where they can direct their own services when they're eligible for personal care attendant services. This will do is allow them to look at activities that they wouldn't need to necessarily buy from a person. It could look at technology and other means of assistance as well as directing those. And lastly, we want to support better informed decisions so that people can make good decisions about what they want and to look at indicators to guide those decisions, making them available publicly so people know what is available about the quality of services, the quality of providers and outcomes so that they can make decisions to guide them in the future.
Thank you, Patty.
Alex, you said earlier that in your review of looking at having one big waiver, that there would be a significant increase in costs. As long as you're pulling together additional information, the assumptions that you put into that to say that there would be increased costs, I'd be interested in seeing, because I do think there's some administrative savings, there's gaps in service savings, there's other things built in to having a more unified waiver approach as someone turns magically 65 and moves from one program to the next. So I'd be interested in seeing that analysis on why it would cost that much more.
Alexis.
Madam Chair, we will get that. Just to know some of the activities I was talking about with the comprehensive assessment, streamlining the service menu, will address some of those as well. But we'll get the additional information.
Are you saying that that comprehensive assessment is the additional cost that you're talking about?
No. I'm just saying that some of the steps we're taking now are going to help alleviate some of the barriers that exist because of the differences, even without just consolidating it.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there any other question at this time? Yes.
Thank you, Senator. Just a question on the self-direction options. Is that available equally across all of the waiver programs as you're envisioning it?
Madam Chair and members, yes, the self-directed option through the waivers is available in each of the waiver programs currently. And what we are developing is an option that will be available to people who are eligible for PCA who are not yet on a waiver program.
Can I just
yes, Representative Thiessen.
Do we have to apply for a federal waiver on that? What's the status of that, or is that done?
It's not completed. We do have a group of stakeholders who is helping us to develop the option prior to submission.
Oh, that just started a meeting. Right, that's that group. Okay. All right, thank you.
Just for my clarification, there already is a program that allows persons to hire their own personal care attendant. They don't have to go through a system for that.
Correct. They don't have to go through a system, but it does limit them to a certain dollar amount and to people. The new option will allow someone, for example, if they wanted Lifeline, to be able to purchase Lifeline in addition to some of the help.
Some of the options that are not included in that. Todd?
In the words of Emerald, could you take it up a level on that consumer directed and say just a couple words about what happened in Hennepin in 01, I don't know if you remember that, but the notion that it's beyond control of personal care services, that it could be broader. And I said, I talked to a woman who was in the Hennepin program last week, and she talked about managing her own money, the whole pot of money. But maybe for the purposes of the committee, you could say beyond personal care, how did that go?
When people were told how much money we would have spent on their services if we were to authorize them and given the flexibility to come up with a plan, what we found is that they planned ahead. They looked across the year. They figured out when they would have additional needs. They reserved backups. They worked across families. They looked at who they wanted to hire and how they were going to train and incent that person so that they would stay with them over time. They also looked at what types of modifications to their home or other activities could really help them achieve outcomes. And we did see, we saw families being able to do things that they've never been able to do before. We saw people starting to get jobs. We saw some very creative ways of looking at supporting individuals in their own homes.
Where I was going was to push it past personal care and flexibility. That would be, to me, the next level up is to say beyond the 1915J, what's next? And that's where I was going with the CDCS, and I thought that was starting back then, and I kind of got squashed. But to say that would be a potential thing for this committee to look at, does that seem realistic?
To look at?
Beyond 1915J, I mean, in terms of sort of federal regs and rules and control on.
You mean doing a consumer directed to any state plan option? That might in total be a little bit more right now, but it than what we could have approved. But I think we need to look at how to make all of these options work more effectively.
Thank you. Okay, I think now that we'll move to Pam.
Pam Parker, special needs purchasing. I'm going to go off in a little bit different direction. I'm going to talk about how we can package all of these tools and building blocks of the waivers, the state plan services, and look at integration of their service delivery. And
Pam, Emma, excuse me for interrupting. Is there something that we should be looking at as you're presenting?
There was a presentation called Integrated Medicare and Medicaid Programs, Managed Care Programs for Special Needs Populations. Hopefully you have that. It was available at the last meeting. I didn't bring it again. Could have brought more copies again, but I thought we already had it, so we had passed it out last time. Maybe I should just. Oh, yes, that's what it looks like.
It looks like this. How many would like a copy?
Have some maps on the back. Well, I'm afraid I'll probably just, in the interest of time, I need to keep going.
Yes.
Sorry. So I'm going to talk a little bit then about how you can integrate and package these things across all these different pieces of the system, particularly the financing pieces between Medicare and Medicaid, the acute and long-term care, you know, meaning the main medical services, and then the long-term care things, including the waivers, the home and community-based waivers. And the mechanism that we're using for this in Minnesota is our managed care programs, and we do incorporate all of the things that they've just discussed. These people set the policy, and we try to integrate it into the delivery system using some of our managed care plans. So the consumer-directed, the outcomes, all of the comprehensive assessment tools that are being built, these are things that we are already using as much as we can, whatever we have in these basic programs. We use them in our managed care programs as well. And as they develop this comprehensive assessment, the health plans are involved in looking at that, and then they use these same tools and the same kinds of outcome and oversight development we try to incorporate then into those programs. But where we have really been a leader in Minnesota has been in the integration of Medicare and Medicaid, and I want to focus a little bit on what's been driving that. We have a lot of people, of course, that have chronic conditions that are the basis of why they end up in the long-term care system. And what we're trying to do is look at how can we upstream the management of those chronic care conditions a little bit better to look at prevention and better management across the whole system. 50% of people with disabilities that are on Medicaid are eligible for Medicare, and about 95% of the seniors are eligible for Medicare. And, of course, so Medicare pays for the primary and acute care. And states generally have no leverage over the Medicare dollars. The Medicare does its own thing. The docs are out there. We have no connection with them, particularly, to be able to manage them. unless we figure out how to manage or influence those clinical drivers that start back in the primary and acute care system, we're going to suffer the consequences of the long range on the long-term care end if we don't try to figure out how we can interface with that and get the bang for the buck from the whole system. So it really makes sense to figure out how we can interface with Medicare. And especially now since Medicare has taken over the drug costs. Drugs are, as we all know, a major intervention strategy for treatment of many illnesses and many chronic conditions. And if we have no control over the drugs for most of our Medicaid people, we don't even know what they are. We don't get that information anymore because they're provided through the big Medicare Part D system now. And so when that happened, that further fragmented the care for people who get both Medicare and Medicaid, which, as you see, is most of the people that are in our long-term care system. There is a new option under Medicare that is allowing us to piggyback on it and try to use it as a building bridge to integrate, and that's called the Medicare Special Needs Plan. It's a type of Medicare Advantage plan that has to provide drugs and other Medicare benefits to the people that it serves, and they are allowed these for the first time. Medicare is allowing these plans to focus just on a specific population. So, for instance, just dually eligible people, Medicare and Medicaid eligible, dually eligible with people with disabilities or people that are seniors. So we are taking advantage of that. And we've actually been the pioneer in doing this. For over 10 years, we've had a demonstration program that has served both seniors in one program and then people with disabilities in another program in integrating Medicare and Medicaid. And what we've done is we've been able to transition those programs into this new special needs plan option with Medicare so that we are no longer a demonstration and we are a permanent part of the Medicare system now in our programs. So what I want to do is to talk to you just a little bit about what our goals are in those integrated programs and some of the barriers, and then just describe to you a little bit too of what the integrated programs are and what we're doing with them. But our goals, I was struck by your mission statement, that our goals are very, I think, in alignment with your mission statement. We want to align the fiscal incentives between Medicare and Medicaid so that they don't conflict, so that they line up to, you know, get us the long-range result, the right care at the right time, as you've been saying. We want to simplify the system, at least for the beneficiary. Simplifying the system for access for the beneficiary doesn't always mean simplifying it for us or simplifying it for the provider. Sometimes it isn't so simple for them when we do this. But we want to make sure that for the beneficiary, it's seamless for them. And that's what I think we've been trying to achieve. We want to increase some accountability across the whole system. We want to increase care coordination and navigation options for people and facilitate more primary care visits and preventive visits, more assessment of people at the front end so that we can see their whole condition, be able to plan for what's going to happen to them across the healthcare system. We want better communication links between primary, acute, and long-term care, and we want to build in the kinds of practice protocols that are specific to people with disabilities or to geriatrics and use the kind of practitioners like nurse practitioners who can often substitute care at a cheaper level or a more effective level for some of our other practitioners. And then, of course, we want to ensure the quality of care, and focusing on the specific needs of each population. So that's what's kind of driving our purchasing strategy. Now, the programs that we have for seniors, I'll just do a quickie thumbnail sketch of them. And it is, if people have this handout, it's really hard to follow this without a handout. I'm right now on page 3 of this, and I was going to refer you to a little chart on page 9, but we have basically 3 managed care programs for seniors. Our basic program has been around for over 20 years. We've had, and we call it Minnesota Senior Care now. It's changed its name, but it's the same program. And it is not very integrated. It's just the Medicaid basic care services. It doesn't have a lot of long-term care or anything. It does have a lot of PCA and home care in it, but it doesn't have a lot of the other long-term care services on. And that program is actually being phased out. Currently, we have about 9,700 people in that program, but it's being phased out. The other program that we have that's a mandatory program is called Minnesota Senior Care Plus. That does integrate the long-term care pieces in with the basic care pieces. So it takes the waiver programs that Alex has just described for the seniors and puts it in there. And that program is just starting. We've had that in 25 counties, and next year we're expanding it to another 50-some counties. So it'll be almost statewide in 2008, and we're adding the metro area in 2009. But the largest program that we have is now our integrated Medicare and Medicaid program. Neither one of those programs that I just mentioned, senior care programs, neither one of them include Medicare. So all the Medicare is separate. So a person still has to be in a health plan for Medicaid and a separate Medicare plan for their Part D drugs. So that's not the most ideal situation. But what we have is also the Minnesota Senior Health Options Program, which is our largest program, and most of the seniors in the state that are on Medicaid now are in that program. It's about 36,000 seniors. And most of the home and community-based waiver services that Alex described for seniors are provided through that program now in Minnesota. So they are integrated with Medicare and Medicaid, and then all the drugs are provided, and there's a lot of care coordination. And we are doing this, again, like I said, through our contracts with these special needs plans to get the Medicare side in to leverage the whole system across the whole system. When we do that, we get all the drug information. We get all the encounter data information on what's going on with Medicare. We can do quality assurance programs across the Medicare and the Medicaid. Our health plan partners have been very willing to share information on the Medicare side. Our contracts cover a lot of things that go over into the Medicare world to try to leverage that, and they've been innovative in figuring out how to do that. So we're now following a similar track for people with disabilities on page 4. Now, we do not have the same situation for people with disabilities as we do for seniors, where seniors are mandatorily included in a managed care program. People with disabilities are largely served under our fee-for-service systems. And so then it's been more difficult to integrate these services together and figure out how to make their primary and acute care, their preventive care, hook up to their long-term care, because we haven't had any mechanisms for that. We've had one small demonstration that UCare Minnesota and Access Healthcare are sponsored, and you heard a little bit about that last time with their presentation. That's called MINDO. It's in the 7-county metro area. It's about 7,000 or about 900 people, it's a very, very comprehensive program in terms of all those waivers that Alex mentioned are all incorporated into there with all of their rules and everything that the health plans have to follow too. We don't give them special rules. They have to have the same rules and follow those same rules. But they can look at the picture across the whole array of care and manage that. Now that program is not allowed to expand right now. It's just going to sit in the metro area according to the current law. But what we have been given the authority to do that we're just rolling out now is a new program for people with disabilities that is rolling out largely statewide on January 1, 2008. And I have a typo in a chart here. So later on when you see that chart, just remember it's not 2007, it's 2008. And it is correct on this slide on page 4. But anyway, this program will not include long-term care services. So the integration that we're going to try to do in this program is from Medicare and Medicaid basic care and all of the drugs, so that a person with disabilities can go and choose to enroll in one of these programs. It's totally voluntary, and they will be able to get all their drugs from Medicare in one place, whereas right now they're going to get drugs from three places if they're on fee-for-service. They get drugs from Medicare Part D, where they have to be enrolled in a special plan to do that. Then they get Medicare drugs from Part B, and they get Medicaid drugs from the Medicaid system. That's the three places people get their drugs, and it's very confusing. People don't know what's Part B drug versus a Part D drug versus a Medicaid drug. You know, most of us as individuals would never be able to keep track of that. And so this way, all their drugs can be in one place. The health plans that are participating in this have all also put on the table additional benefits that they can get through their leveraging with Medicare, and they're buying down some of our Medicaid copays for this year, for instance, for 2008. So we are trying to leverage not only the care coordination that we can get across that part of the system, but also some of the extra benefits that they have available to them through some of their flexibility with their Medicare money. And they are also providing additional navigation assistance for every member with additional care coordination. Now, that won't be on the long-term care side, but they are trying to contract with the counties and interface that with what the counties are doing for that. So that's a new program.
Excuse me,
we
Patty.
Expect that to be a platform also for this was a question from last time. We hope that this can be a platform for the mental health initiative as they are trying to figure out how to integrate Medicare into what they're doing, that some of these SNPs with their experience that they're going to gain with people with disabilities and have them, some of them are have them already enrolled just for Medicare alone already. They're just sitting there waiting for us to come with the Medicaid side now in January.
Pam, there's a question. Are you ready
sure.
for can
yeah,
I
sorry.
Patty, go ahead.
So before you switch the page here, the MDO, which integrates everything,
yeah,
versus the SNBC, I think, of TV here.
Yeah. We've tried to find a better name.
Yeah. I'm assuming that the costs for MDO, the average costs or the actuary costs, however you've determined the cost, is far greater than the cost for a non-integrated approach, which is SNBC, integrating everything as an MDO. Have you done a cost comparison? Well, maybe it's not more expensive. Someone who's not in MDO, someone who's in MDO, or someone who is getting two sets of services under SNBC, have you done a comparison of that? I hate to sound like I'm all about money, but I'm just trying to figure out which mechanism will cost the system more.
Madam Chair, Patty, these programs have been designed to be budget neutral, not to save a lot of money, but it depends on the population that's in there. These are voluntary programs. You can't control who's going to enroll. MDO has a very, very extremely high-end need group. That who's been attracted to that in-depth model of care coordination and in-depth model of all their home and community-based services. We set the rates technically so that we're not spending more than we would normally spend for that person in the fee-for-service world. But that's different. I mean, but who they actually get and what their average costs are it doesn't tell you very much because it's that high-end group of people that have happened to enroll. Now, if you take the fee-for-service costs that will still be there for the people in SNP basic care and add the basic care costs that we're going to be providing through the health plan contract, it should come out to be even. That's the idea. Now, maybe over time there's time for savings or something, but right now we're just starting out with that proposition that it's even. But it depends on what person, who's going to choose to enroll. If the low-end people choose to enroll or the high-end people choose to enroll. And we have a risk adjustment system that will help us adjust the payment accordingly so that we're not, so that the plan is fairly paid and so that we're not overpaying and underpaying, constantly. So.
Okay, thank you. Todd?
Pam, I always thought the beauty of MSHO was the merging of money and more being able to be more creative. I wondered if you had quantified.
Would you say that again? I did not hear you.
Oh, the merging of the money was always created more flexibility. In other words, putting Medicare and Medicaid together. And you had mentioned the additional benefits, the beauty of that. Have you ever quantified those additional benefits in some fashion?
Madam Chair, Todd, the additional benefits, we do have some ways of quantifying them. But largely, they come through the Medicare side, and they have to be published on websites and things like that. The flexibility part of the benefits, I don't think we've been able to quantify in the same way. But the Medicare benefits they have to be published along with the bid information that right. Medicare plans do.
Pam, may I ask a question?
Yes.
I'm always a little afraid at this point of asking a question because it may expose that I did not get some essential concept that you've been talking about for 20 minutes. But when we're talking about cost here, and we're integrating this in a way so that from the consumer is not experiencing all of this massive confusion, and we're talking about cost, as Patty was asking, for neutrality. Each of these, what we're integrating are these different programs that have funding sources all associated with them.
So we're just pooling those dollars in some way. In a simplistic way, that's how I'm visualizing it. So it's not increasing costs or decreasing costs. It's taking the resources from the various programs, pulling them together, and then allowing the driver to be the consumer at some level in terms of organizing their own care, or at least not having to deal with the complexity of three different sets of funding sources for a person's drugs. Have I got that essential principle correct? That's what you've been saying?
I think you have that exactly right. There are, we do feel that in the MSHO program, where it's a larger program and it's more across the population, and we've had 10 years of experience, we do have seen some cost savings there that we think are, you know, there are some efficiencies there.
We are interested in those also.
But we have not, I have to say, we've never designed these programs specifically to save money in that way, because when you take a savings out of managed care, it's sort of a one-time thing. And you take that chunk, and then, you know, you're down here at the next level, and you can't keep going down, down, down. Otherwise you're driving yourself into the ground. So there's a certain amount of what we're trying to do is build a platform for long-range, better management of chronic care conditions, and hopefully at the long-range end, then there's more efficient use of medical services and better management of those conditions, so that they don't flare up as much and don't use as much long-term care.
It's prevention, yeah. Health maintenance.
Jan. That's very hard to quantify.
Jan.
Pam just said the magic words. I was just going to make the same point, essentially, that it. What's so hard about all of these cost savings calculations, and I think it came up in UCARE's presentation a little last week, where you attribute the costs and the cost savings, you know, the costs you're saving for Medicare may show up in the Medicare budget, not in the in the state share of the dollar. So it's having to calculate the cost savings on the total and not on the components, and over a much longer period of time than we typically do. And I think the jury's still out, but has a ton of promise if we really can prevent secondary disabilities and complications that wouldn't have had to happen, you know, the cost savings 10 years from now. And it's always, of course, hard to prove a negative, hard to prove that it was because of this that didn't happen. But with large enough populations, I mean, and statistical modeling, hopefully we'll be able to do that.
And, Madam Chair, I think some of the issues, too, are we're not quite where we need to be with the federal government on getting our share of the Medicare savings. That is one of the things that integrating with the special needs plans is there's groups of people around the country as we speak here, small groups but intense little groups working on these things, as Gita and Glenn and others know, that are trying to figure out how to incent health plans and states to work together by having the states be able to share in some of the cost savings from the Medicare side, so that doesn't all just go to somebody else.
Right. And that's going to be across the whole healthcare payment system.
Right,
you know,
we're not quite there.
Recapturing the savings.
Yeah, we're not quite there yet, though there are some small things that can be done.
Representative Thiessen has a question, and then we'll...
Well, it's more of a comment, but just to say that unless we start trying to find out these savings, I mean, you say that you're doing this in a way that is supposed to be cost neutral. I think you shouldn't do that. I think you need to start thinking of this in a way that's actually going to save money and start focusing on that now, because, well, I've been on health committees for 3 years, which is not very long. We talk about savings all the time. And people say things are going to save all kinds of money. And I've heard presentation after presentation, but no one ever shows me where that money is. And it's starting to drive me crazy. So I think from your guys' perspective, from the department's perspective, I think we actually need to shift a little bit and start thinking about not only how is this going to be better for the consumers, which is really important, but how are we actually going to take money for the state out of the system? Because otherwise, the health plans or the providers are going to keep the money, and they'll make more money, and we won't see any savings. So we really got to push much harder on that. Anyway, that's my...
Show me the money, in other words.
We don't want to overpromise, though. But I understand your point.
I just want to emphasize that. I'm hearing this through I'm on two other of these committees, and it's a similar message, I'm sure, on those, that
that if we are, one of our goals is reducing the inflationary costs of health care, that we have to recapture some of those dollars and actually demonstrate a reduction in health care costs rather than, for example, if you get a $500 savings by using a bundle to treat chronic diabetic, the care of the chronic diabetic, and you can save money in the long-term deterioration. That, and one of my public health committees said it was $500. I said, well, where is the reduction in the cost of care for that person of $500? Or where does that $500 go, in a reserve, or it's going to do something other than create a reduction in what is being described as the increasing cost of health care? We're running short on time. Is there a critical point you want to make for us, or can people ask you a few more questions at this time? Pam?
Madam Chair, if I can just maybe respond. I do have to explain that there are some parameters. There's something called actuarial soundness. It's a federal thing that we have to follow, and we don't have carte blanche in just saying we're going to set our rates at a certain level that's lower, and we have to follow all of that, and you have to look at, you know, all the actual costs and inflation and all that kind of stuff and account for all that. So it isn't quite as simple as what, you know, it might seem.
No, and I understand that. If I could just, but if there are cost savings, that should show up in your actuarial work, it seems to me. I mean, so that's the piece
right.
that I've never been able to connect.
Right,
to.
I understand that.
And the other part that I heard that I'm interested in as well is the administrative, not only for the consumer to have that confusion and chaos be reduced, but I think the next step clearly is how do we add that to the interior administration, the system, that it is also seamless, that it also has less of these silos that everybody's trying to figure out. You have to have an expert figuring out all these systems. That ought to be simplified as well administratively.
And, Madam Chair, that is one of the things that we recognize. We are trying to encourage the counties and health plans to partner, and they are doing incredible things in that regard so that we can build on the same systems that we have out there, but just maybe do a little bit more and a little bit different with them, involving the counties more in some of the chronic care issues, getting the health plans more involved in some of the social service issues and some of the you know, chemical dependency and mental health services. So those are parts of our strategies as well. I have some other slides here that you can look at that talk about some of those challenges and some of the differences between the seniors and the people with disabilities and what their thoughts are, what they've conveyed to us as we've worked with them with regard and some of the challenges that we have in terms of getting these programs into that a new realm of being a little bit more smooth. We're kind of new into the big expansions that we've just had in the seniors program, and we're learning a lot through that. There's been there's some rough edges around that because it's so new, and we were pushed into that with the Part D so quickly. So there are some things that we're working on together with the county.
Thank you very much. I'm hoping that you'll be able to hang around. We're going to be looking at a document now that I've asked to be prepared for our discussion, and I'd invite you to participate in that. And if there's anything else that you'd like to communicate with us online, or if we get some chance to have some meetings outside of the committee hearing, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I could comment on the cost issues that you and Representative Thiessen raised, and very, very appropriately, because that's something that particularly in your roles you have to look at. I would want to make sure that in our roles we're looking at the big and the bigger picture. And I would look at Ms. Bartolik did talk about the increasing waiting list on the developmental disability waiver. I think is a good example. It may very well be that the cost per person being served goes down, but the savings in aggregate aren't there because more people are being served. And I would look at those 1,500 or 1,800. I'd understood what it was, but whatever the number is, it's a large number, and largely the savings wouldn't be incurred from that chart because those individuals are not in the more expensive facility where they would be did we not have the waiver in place. I would also want to note also where are those individuals coming from. The vast majority of those 1,500 people on the waiting list have come on the waiting list as they graduated from high school. And so what we've seen is our educational system, those of you who are in the legislature, in your roles as funding the education system, particularly the special ed system, have invested tens of thousands, in some cases hundreds of thousands, in individuals to get them to some level of developmental achievement during their high school years. When they graduate from high school and basically go on hold until they can become eligible and get off the waiting list for the developmental disability waiver, they're now without services, except for whatever the family can cobble together, which means many of those gains that were achieved through the investment in the educational system are now being lost, and because they're lost, the cost of serving them under the developmental disability waiver after a 3 or 4 or 5 year waiting period goes up dramatically. And I would hope we would be able to look at that full scan, that full scope of the costs.
Representative Thiessen,
and then to the extent that there's information that you can track, I mean, if there's information that can track those higher costs 4 or 5 years down, that probably would be very helpful. Okay. That would be great.
Also, I would want to draw your attention to there's a letter that is a very well-constructed letter from Mike Weber that's in your materials that I hope that's okay with you, Mike, that I distributed this letter.
Sure, that's fine.
To the
Thank you, Senator.
Articulating some of these concerns. And Jan, I think you also had a statement.
Yeah,
to make.
Just as the folks from DHS were talking, and we're talking about costs, I think one of the neat ideas that we've already come up with as a committee, as a possible product, is this much higher level mapping of cost shifting in the system that I think would be really a valuable work product that would go beyond kind of the even, you know, what we typically think of as the healthcare sector, to capture Mike's point, you know, where some of the real lost opportunities might be. So I think if when we get into our discussion about our products, I think constructing the kind of cost-shifting map that we, some of us, have envisioned is a great thing, and it's going to be complicated to do. So how we kind of marshal our forces maybe outside the committee meeting to work on a draft of that cost shift map would be really important, I think.
That's right, and I know that's concept is included in the materials that we're going to be reviewing now, so why don't we move ahead with the fourth item, which is the discussion of the concept papers that are in your materials. Michael Scandrett is going to go through these with us. We're going to begin with the deliverables document, followed by the goals and design principles document, and then review the recommendations to other work groups document. And the reason we're and then on our discussion, we're going to reverse that order. And the reason we're going to reverse that order is because the recommendations to other work groups is a timeliness issue, and I would really like to be able to move through that today so that we can at least have some preliminary distribution of those ideas to the other work groups who started meeting earlier than we did and may be moving closer to making their recommendations than we are. So we want to get in before they actually get that documented and have our input to the other groups. So with that, I'm going to turn this over. In terms of our strategy for going through the materials that are in front of you, what I'm asking you to do is to review this in a kind of a holistic way. Now, Michael, are you planning to go through all three documents first and then have discussion after all the documents?
We're going to go through all three of them, so if people will take notes, and then we'll come back for discussion after we've completed the three documents.
You can ask questions for clarification, but we would ask you to hold challenges or suggestions for additions until after we've reviewed all of the documents. Thank you.
Okay. I think we're ready. Let's start with the deliverables document. It says possible work group deliverables, and the draft date is 9/27/07. And these are all these documents are just our best ideas to put forth and don't necessarily reflect any decisions of the group. Senator Sharon wants to move quickly, and it's easier to move quickly when you have something to react to. So just because it's here does not mean that you all have agreed to it. It definitely does not mean that.
Yes, and it really is an extraction of what we're hearing. We're pulling together, and it may not be inclusive. We'll give you an opportunity to have some input into this, but it gets us something to work off of.
And we have based it a lot on the previous discussions, and we're guessing at what you might want to have in here, and if we guess wrong, you need to point that out to us. The first document is trying to get more tangible about what this work group would be producing in the way of deliverables. And one concept, the first one, is the design principles, and this would be focused really at the highest level and would also be the wildest dreams type of concept. It's getting away from what we currently have in the system. Ideally, how would people experience the system? What would happen to them at different places along the continuum of care? How would services be provided to them, and so forth? So just so we have a sense of where we wish we were, knowing that we have to start from where we are and may never get to that wildest dreams system. The second is recommendations to the other healthcare reform work groups, which would be a more immediate product that would hopefully get to the work groups before they have finalized their own recommendations and would help them think a little differently about their recommendations in terms of the global view of the system and especially the issues of what they might do in the health insurance context may have an effect in the long-term or continuum care context. And some of our recommendations about what the consumers have said to us about how they experience the system. So on these, we would try to get these done mostly today, finalize them next week, and get them out to the other work groups immediately after that. The third concept is the one Jan just mentioned. It's to try to create a visual that maps the entire healthcare system. And on that map shows the continuum of care from people that are very healthy to people who are very sick or need a lot of healthcare services. And to try to show on that map the different programs, services, public and private funding streams, and then use the map to illustrate how the cost shifting can occur or what people's experiences are like as they move through the system. And we'll, I'm sure, illustrate a lot of complexity of the system, but will also be a useful tool in understanding the cause and effect of different changes in parts of the system on other sectors. The fourth is just called micro models in here, and that is looking at the presentations we've had, which of all the options in the world are the most integrated because they have both the health insurance aspect and the continuing and long-term care aspect for the most part, and to look at those existing models and also look at what barriers there are for those models to be used and then how they can be more coordinated between the models more effectively. The fifth would then be got the micro models and then connecting the dots be further how it gets a little bit at what the department talked about in terms of a consolidated waiver or some approach to bringing more integration across these micro models. The sixth is a concept that to make this more real to people and help them understand what the individual's experience is to create case studies that would illustrate both how people, what happens when people experience the current system with the fragmentation and the different silos of funding, and then how we would hope that people would experience a reformed system with changes that we would be recommending. A seventh is to get specific about areas where there are potential cost savings as well as ways to capture savings and reallocate it based on the experiences with the programs that we've been looking at here. And number eight is because there was some discussion already about a lot of the strategies that are going to make most of the difference are long-range strategies, but people are impatient, and so to try to find things that could be more immediate cost savings or improvements, the low-hanging fruit, in addition to those longer-range strategies that will take time to pay off. And then the final concept is one that also has come up from several members is whether there needs to be some ongoing effort after this initial round and what that might look like on an ongoing basis. So that's the deliverables. And then I'm going to go next to the goals and design principles. That's also dated 9/27/07. And what we've done here is take the goal statement that the group has approved and to break that into the categories of the goal statement and to try to start plugging in some concepts that would help to further explain what each of those concepts means. So, for example, what does patient-centered mean? We say that in the goal statement. Well, it means individual choice and control, ability to navigate, flexibility to get the services that a person needs with their unique situation. And then, as we heard from the consumers, trying to optimize health and to create opportunities for people to participate meaningfully in their community as being part of what a patient-centered system will do. A seamless, streamlined access, fewer transitions and smoother transitions, and continuity of care as people change or move through different parts of the system. Integrated is about how the money follows the person and kind of combining the funding rather than having fragmented funding and services. Some sort of unified service plan and coordination of care within that plan. And then also the goals of reducing costs through greater efficiency and preventing cost shifting. And then finally, ways to address other things that affect people's health status that aren't necessarily in the healthcare system. And the final concept of promoting health and self-sufficiency is both prevention and also identifying conditions earlier and doing secondary prevention to prevent complications or deterioration of people's health. So that's kind of the more detailed goal statement. The design principles, and again, we're just throwing these out because we think that's what we've been hearing from people in the discussion in the past and from some of the presenters. One is a concept of integration, and the ultimate goal being to try to have as much integration and coordination as possible, including both the funding integration as well as the coordination between the long-term and continuum care system and the health insurance system. Second concept, a related concept, is coordination of care. The concepts here are, just in general terms, some sort of unified service plan, the concept of a healthcare home where people have a real connection with someone who helps them to stay healthy and also to get the healthcare they need. And then the third, coordination with non-healthcare services that are often important to people maintaining their health and preventing health problems. The third major category is the smooth transitions, and this the concepts here about also mentioned by the department in their presentation, greater uniformity across programs with some sort of comprehensive assessment and common menu of services, and then transition planning so that there's always a process of understanding where a person will be moving next and beginning to plan early rather than a person starting over as they move, for example, from a hospital to a nursing home without any continuity between their ultimate goals for getting back into the community. The next is prevention and health promotion, looking globally at the system. Where are all the opportunities to keep people as healthy as possible in order to prevent them from moving into the long-term care and chronic care categories? Another is the system-wide view of healthcare reform. This is back to the MAP concept that helping the other work groups identify where the impact is of changes they may make, which may produce savings within their sectors, but may actually produce a cost in other sectors and may shift costs to others rather than saving on a net basis. Payment incentives gets at the payment reform model that the payment system should reward the kind of outcomes and services that we want to have. And with that is necessary to have an evaluation system so that when you do have payment incentives, you're basing it on some information on what services are producing the outcomes that you want. Consumer directed, we talked about a lot already and is in our goal statement and about greater consumer choice and control over their health care. The final one is high quality, competent health care providers and care coordinators. This gets at both the quality of care and the shortages of particular types of providers as well as care coordinators. so that we have adequate supply as well as adequately trained providers that can, again, produce the outcomes that we're looking for. So now we'll go on to the final document, which is the recommendations to other work groups. And by this time, you should recognize everything because all of our recommendations, I hope, are consistent with our goals and design principles. Recommendations to the other group are six. The first is that they should be sure to look at their work group's recommendations in light of impacts on other part of the entire healthcare system, not just look at the under 65 non-disabled persons, and then also look at where their cost savings may be offset by cost increases in other areas. The second major concept is to look at the total spending on healthcare, including the current cost cross subsidies and cost shifting that occurs. And then Dale Thompson isn't here, but early on he raised this concept, so we're trying to honor his presence at the first meeting by where he brought up, if you truly think of leveraging all the dollars in the system, not just looking at one part of the system, the opportunities may be greater both for the resources needed to improve care and do prevention, as well as the potential cost savings that might occur when you look at the total dollars rather than just dollars in one part of the system. The third is the concept of looking at both the cost savings and the capturing of savings to be reinvested. Again, it's the big picture view of how you can move dollars around in the system in order to achieve what you want to achieve in each section. And then fourth is the concept of integration and smooth transitions that we have in our design principles that, again, then rather than looking at just one part of the system, the other work groups are encouraged to look at how that will affect people's transitions from that their system that they may be looking at to other systems, and to avoid more complexity and more fragmentation, which, as we heard from the consumers and people around the table, that the complexity and fragmentation of the system may be the biggest problem that stands in the way of both quality of care and cost containment. And then the emphasis on prevention and health promotion and looking at opportunities along the whole continuum of care to keep people healthier and by doing that reduce costs in the system. And then I think Sue brought this up, is encouraging people to use pilot projects rather than to jump into wide-scale statewide changes before we know what the effect will be on people. So that's the three documents, and because we have some time sensitivity around the recommendations to other groups, we thought we would start with that document that I just went through, and obviously the design principles and others will come up during that discussion, but we want to try to get at least everyone's most important concerns or suggestions for additions to the document. We are going to assume that things are okay in the document unless you bring them up. So we're not going to go through and discuss each part of the document one by one, because I think then we tend to get stuck on the first section that we discuss. So as you've been hearing this and as you think about the discussion, write down those things that you either object to or have concerns about, or the things you think are missing from the document, or you'd like to add those. And as you bring those up, encourage you to start with your most important things, because I'm pretty sure we're not going to get to your entire list. And when we run out of time, we want you to send whatever you have left to us, and we will try to incorporate as much as we can later on, but we want everybody to at least raise their most important concerns or their ideas for additions to the documents.
Okay, so we'll begin with that. I'm just going to emphasize what we're looking for is not agreements, not what you agree with or like, to be sort of blunt, but really what you think you might disagree with that's in here or what is missing. And we're asking you to make one suggestion at a time so that we can move around and make sure that everyone here gets a chance to speak to their priority for these documents. And we will begin with the other Healthcare Access Commission working group document. Yes, please go ahead.
I'd just like to see something included in here about the diversity of the patient population that we're talking about, at least from our experience with the dual eligible programs. There are some unique ways that services need to be provided for Somali elder or Somali disabled, for example. And we haven't recognized that at all in here, and at least the state public program membership overall tends to be more diverse than the rest of the population. So I think it would be important to recognize that. At least on one other group I'm sitting on, people haven't really understood some of the differences in the population.
So adding some important elements around diversity and recognizing the health disparities issue. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
I wanted to add parity, knowing that some of the other groups are, you know, talking about maybe pared-down proposals or bare-bones kind of healthcare coverage. I want to make sure that mental health parity is a key recommendation out of this committee.
That certainly when we get to principles, we might want to make sure that that's a part of the principles. Go ahead, Gail.
On item 3 of the recommendations, I would just like to suggest that we add an example. I think we're assuming a common vocabulary with the other groups who might look at this, and I think that one cries out for an example where a savings might occur in one sector or an action might occur in one sector, but the savings actually is attributed in another.
Thank you, Akil. Jan?
I think similar to Sue's comment, as we're looking at the work groups that are looking at benefit design, that it's understandable that people usually go to where can we cut benefits to make the premium cheaper, but our whole point is look at the total cost and the longer-term cost, so not only around mental health parity, but things like the definition of the whole notion that's kind of so backwards in acute care, that the minute you reach your maximum level of recovery in an acute care context, the coverage ends, then leading to entirely predictable deterioration in health that we'll start paying for again after you trip back into an acute care disease box. So I would hope that we could get quite concrete in our recommendations to the work groups looking at benefit design around mental health parity, adequacy of services that maintain health, and not just pursue this illusory cure notion of acute care.
So we might add something that says support health maintenance in the benefit design as a way of
with specifics, like don't stop paying for therapies once somebody's not going to get any better.
Right.
You need to keep them from getting worse as well as...
And that there's a cost savings associated with that.
Right.
Very good, Jan. Go ahead, Todd.
My overarching one would be metrics. What are the metrics? Jim Solem said in 1991 in Arne Carlson's Long-Term Care Commission, how are we going to keep score? And so for me, it's the case definition of the person. I mean, it's very fuzzy to me, disabled with complex health. And you can pick whatever. What's the metric, and how do we know if we're making progress or not? It was Ed Koch, as mayor of New York City, said, how am I doing? How do we measure that? And it may be a little bit different, but at least if we put a stake in the ground, we can say we want to be here. Here are intermediate results, like smoking. It's our second day here in the state. And we monitored and matched it. We've done it with kids smoking campaign. I mean, just the metrics of the kind of thing. And then the case definition would be awfully nice to have it, because I started out thinking it was MA recipients who are something. But then it wanders into know everyone. It's not entirely clear if we're talking about all 5 or 6 million people in Minnesota, whatever. But the metrics of how we're each group's doing, maybe it can be melded into a way to keep track of what we're doing.
Patty. Under number 2, where you're talking about the big picture of total spending, I think we had a meeting or two ago where I'd like to have affordable housing somehow. As soon as you start with healthcare, you forget that some of the other barriers that cause people to move somewhere is affordable housing, or even the education example that you gave, Mike. I never thought of that, you know, they invested all this in the education system, and then what? So when you start out with spending on health care,
I'd like it tends to limit it to just one look, and when these other groups aren't focusing as much on the continuum of care and they're focusing on acute care, they're going to forget about some of the social issues that we've discussed in this group. So I'd like that somehow added in there.
Criminal justice system is another one.
Yes, Mike.
I think what's in front of us addresses very well cost shifting at the same time. I'd like to have something in here about the deference of cost on a timely basis. And what I'm thinking, one of the advantages in a long-term single-payer system is I'm going to pay for it anyway, so let me pay for it cheaper now to prevent something 5 years down the road. Like when Paul Elwood started the HMOs, he had sort of the same model. That falls apart as soon as there's a high transition of time. I don't want to invest my funds in preventing something 3 years down the road because I probably won't be paying for that 3 years down the road. And if we could incorporate somehow that, I guess the transition, maybe we could take the health portability concept, which was supposed to fix things, and talk about the portability of coverage in such a way that the funder who doesn't provide the prevention incurs the cost for the subsequent medical costs.
Interesting. It would be hard to I'll be in court arguing about what the cause and
very
what the
tough
cause
to operationalize.
Joan.
Yes, I'd like to focus on 5 years. We look at prevention. I think as we heard last week from the health department that, you know, they've got some wonderful prevention programs. However, it sounds like the implementation is lacking good funding. And so I think that is something we need to be looking at, because if we've got these prevention programs out there, but they're not being implemented in any capacity, and especially are they looking at the special needs population that we're focusing on, I think that's a concern if we're really truly interested in preventing some of the conditions that do exist.
Okay, this we're focusing on what a list of recommendations we're going to be sending to the other working groups for ideas that they need to be incorporating as they design their recommendations. I'm going to go over with Bob and then back to Mike.
I'm focused on number four, and I think it probably identifies the issue that I'm going to raise. But when I think of integration, I think of integration of the full system, more than just funding and services. And so I'm wondering if some terminology that addresses the fact that we're talking about integration of systems, whether it be county social service systems, health plan systems, state systems, whatever it might be, if we could kind of broaden that statement a little bit to address that.
Integration of systems. Mike.
On the sixth point, I really like the idea of the pilot project from the vantage point of let's not implement something statewide in its new stages. On the other hand, the caution is that we've had many pilots that worked but never got implemented. And if we could address something to the effect of a pilot program that would have some of the ramifications already explored about going to scale. So there's some assumption, this is a pilot, this is a demonstration. If it's effective, here's how it would go to scale. And that's anticipated from day one.
Mike, if I could add to that, and that there's funding. When Gene Wood was talking, it reminded me that those CSSD grants, it was about $10 million, and we were trying to convert a $2 billion industry. You know, and so we need to have something where you can actually try to do it. And your point is to say, have a demo that may be funded that then can go to have a systemic or a broader view. Okay. But we don't invest. I mean, Nokia just spent $18 billion to buy some company so they could be forward thinking. And, you know, we don't ever put very much money into that investment side.
Jan.
I'm not sure which number this fits under, but it's elsewhere in our design principles, that kind of the notion of specialized competency and in things like the medical home, clearly the key recommendation, or certainly one, on some of the cost savings work groups. Last time we talked about, you know, kind of this notion of what is a medical home or where is a medical home, depending on the special needs of the population. And the mental health example, I think, was given. You know, that the psychiatric nurse might be the better primary provider for a certain patient than a generic family practice doc, not to disparage generic family practice or anything like that. But just this notion that
medical home needs to be not again narrowly constructed in an acute care mindset, but that medical home for these populations needs to really reflect that specialized competency.
I think that's really important because I'm serving on a committee that's looking at medical home and struggling with the definition of what is the medical home is. It's a complexity that makes it difficult to move forward with the idea. Right. Go ahead, Sue.
I just wanted to add on number five, effective prevention is good, but when we talk about mental health, we talk about early intervention, so that we get that concept in there, too. You've got prevention, early intervention, and then health promotion.
You know, I'm in the last few comments, especially talking about when we use health, that people automatically go to physical health, mm-hmm. is the theme I'm hearing here, that our language needs to be careful about that because it creates a framing or a construct in people's minds. So maybe we need to think about terminology there that forces people outside of that traditional definition of health. That's across the board, all kinds of issues. Yes.
Yes. One of the comments, and I'm not sure in which area it fits, but is to support the optimization of people in the health and social service sector functioning at their optimum scope of practice. So, you know, for example, in the state of Minnesota, we have nurse practitioners, and we don't allow them prescribing authority. Other states do. That would allow them to have more integrated care. There are ways in which social workers or RNs can provide more integrated care for someone if we've eliminated some of the barriers to their practice and allowed integration at a practitioner level that could be more holistic.
Yeah. Allowing people to practice to their full scope and removing the barriers related to that. Others. Glenn.
Madam Chair, I would, in number six, beyond piloting various things, I think it's kind of a broken record, but the issue of best practices and evidence-based practices, I think, needs to be incorporated so that we're already taking the best of what's working, including those in pilots as well.
All right. Let's move to the next. Excuse me, Mike.
Yeah, just one thing, just to remind people that if anybody brought up a concept that you disagree with, this would be a good time to bring it up, because mm-hmm. we'll assume that if nobody disagrees with any of the concepts raised, that we'll go ahead and put those in. So this would be a good time, if there are any.
Madam
Chair. This is not the final document. Our time will be asking you to continue to think about this and then shoot some things off to us by online, by email, and then we will bring another copy of this back for another look. So go ahead, Glenn, excuse me.
It's not necessarily a disagreement. It's probably a caution. As we're talking, and certainly, again, I fully support the issues of parity, of cost shifts, and so forth. Within our current system, though, how they seemingly get applied, it gets back to mandates that only apply to the fully funded small-based employers. And so we absolutely have to apply this in a way that doesn't get back to, the mandates that end up really hurting the system. So that cost shift goes back the other way, too. So I think we've got it very well covered, to make sure that the cost shifting doesn't go to long-term care, et cetera. But, you know, let's make sure that we're not also penalizing small-based employers, small group employers who can't afford to take on the full burden.
I think, how does the self-insured program get impacted by what we're talking
well,
about?
That's the trick.
That's the point.
The problem.
Yeah. That's the
caution.
Yeah. That's what you were
yes,
implying.
Exactly.
And I just
exactly.
said it right out loud, huh?
You got
okay.
it.
That's my problem. I just say it right out loud. Okay, I think we'll go over to Jan and then Patty. Did I see your hand? Okay, and then let's move to the next.
Perhaps this is more of a process question, but as I'm reading these seem like kind of general recommendations to all the work groups. Mm-hmm. I think there were some suggestions of, you know, specific examples or things that might be a little more tailored. I'm wondering if we also intend to kind of look work group by work group at some point and say, you know, this specific work group, we have this specific question or suggestion. So I'm wondering just about if there's an opportunity to drill it down to a level of detail given what staff or you, Senator, or the other legislators might, or other members here who sit on other work groups, just to make it a little more pointed, perhaps, or specific. I don't know if there's that opportunity.
Mike, would you react to that?
Yeah, I think that it would be very helpful to do that, and that we probably would need help from those of you who are on the work group to help us do that in the areas so that we got a lot to get done by next week. And so if people can take on either a work group or a topic that relates to a work group and put something together for us, that would help a lot. I think also the case studies are examples. It would be great to have everybody at the table come up with a nice example of how the current system works and then how they'd like to see it work under the changes. So we're going to need those, and you're the people who can put those together, so I encourage you to do that part too.
Well, just to pin that down a little bit, I'm trying to find my list of those committees we just had the report on. Here it is. Is there somebody serving on the first identifying healthcare cost savings? There's several of these. So the first one is chaired by, who chairs this one? I'm serving on this one. This is the medical one that's exploring medical home. Is anybody else serving on that committee? So would you take a look at this and make some suggestions for specific recommendations for this task and maybe some examples? Public health? I'm serving on public health as well, so I can take that one. Care workers? Okay, Dave, staff set, so we'll pick that up. Developing new cost containment strategies. Anybody there? Anybody in single payer? Anybody on restructuring? Would anybody like to pick that one up? Would anybody like to pick up the development of new cost containment strategies?
I'd be happy to try that one.
For developing new cost containment strategies? Restructured the healthcare system through identified savings. Insurance market reform. We're not getting many volunteers. Minnesota health, we'll do what we can. You know, we're doing what we can here. Minnesota healthcare transfer, well, is there somebody here on the transformation task force?
Representative
Thiessen is, okay. All right. So we have some task force that we are involved in. If somebody else in during the week, so our assignments then are, if you can make some case study examples to demonstrate our principles, and to that we're talking about, and also to make specific suggestions to those committees that we volunteered for recommendations that they incorporate into their final report. All right, let's move to the next document. Next will be the Goals and Design Principles document. We'll just move around the table, and people can want to pick out their most critical point and make sure everybody gets a chance to at least get their most critical point made.
Did you say point or point? Singular.
Point, and then we'll come back, Todd,
okay,
if you've got more than one.
I'll reinforce Patty's. I don't know if this is a principle or a method, but what's missing here for me is kind of the role of technology or how we think different. And just a quick note, we started with the notion that to help people make informed decisions about long-term care, we need professionals. In other words, the New York Times called it, you take multiple data sources and produce a customized solution, you know, where you live and the services. Well, in the future, the computer will do it. There's something called mashup, and they do it now for other kinds of information, for example, proposing that you want to live somewhere and you want to know daycare and schools. And there are various ways to take data. But my point is that we now rely on people to give you information, which is all good and well, nurses and social workers and case managers and navigators. Down the line, I don't know if it'll be in our lifetime, there will be a way for you to shop and do things yourself. Self-help, again, another theme. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's kind of a virtual way of doing some of the work. So it involves all the things, investment and all that. So it may be a method on some of these, but it's kind of where we're headed, I think, as opposed to where we are now.
Thank you, Todd. Bob?
I'll just keep on this integration across multiple systems, social services, public health, primary health care. I think that integration issue can't be hit hard enough.
Thank you. Wendy?
I would agree with what Bob is saying. With the coordination of services, considering services outside the healthcare capitation that may actually affect health, like an example would be like the WIC program. How are we integrating those services for clients?
Do you want to just keep going around? Gita, do you have something, or you can pass if you want to? Okay, Glenn?
I have nothing brilliant to say.
Okay.
I resemble that remark.
Pass.
Jan passes, too.
I don't have anything at this time.
Pardon? Not yet?
Not yet.
Okay, Gail?
Well, if brilliance is the standard, I should probably pass, too. But we heard last week and the week before a little bit about the important role of the family caregiver. And under the coordination of services section, I think we should somewhere work in the way in which the formal system supports, augments, complements, even incents the informal caregiving network. I think that's the place to put it, is under coordination. It could perhaps be under integration as well.
Representative, did you this time?
I would make a comment related to a concern when we talk about integration, about what can commonly become a medicalization of non-medical type services. And I don't quite know how that's captured here, but there's times in which Medicare rules apply to things that are more community-based services when they become blended together. Mm. So however we capture here, assuring that we don't create unnecessary requirements for services when we merge or blend them together. And then I wasn't here at the time you established your goal, so this is just a personal comment. Whenever I see something being patient-centered, for me it sounds like we're starting with someone being sick and passive. And you've probably already talked about this, but I would welcome seeing the goal being a person-centered system and something being person-centered as opposed to patient-centered.
No, thank you, Wendy.
I would
please.
I want to echo an earlier comment about the importance of the integration of family support and engagement throughout all three documents. It really is missing from all three, and I think we could even be so bold as to say person and family centered from a legislative perspective.
Patty?
Well, my first comment was to change the patient to consumer of healthcare, but
I'll take those comments, because throughout we don't refer to patient again except for that first statement. I'm a little bit confused as to the scope, and I think Todd and I were separated for good reason, because I would have, you know, talked nonstop about a comment he made earlier. When you have someone who's totally private pay versus someone who has public assistance, is there a difference in what we're looking at? Is there, you know, the discussion earlier today, the presentations were for those with means, and I think the state agency is trying to walk that fine line between how much they can do this consumer assessment on those with means. How much can government intrude on someone who might be a future consumer of state assistance if they spend down all their assets? So I would like to see noted somewhere in the design principles on where that line is. Is there a line? And are we talking about anyone who is in need of long-term care services? And I shouldn't use that phrase. Are we talking about anyone that's 65 that has a health care crisis? Or is it just those where there is some kind of financial responsibility for the state? And that isn't clear. It's not written anywhere on who we're talking about. So I don't know if there's an answer or if that's a question.
Well, let's talk about that, because that is part of how can we capture a cost savings is central to that discussion too. Yeah, or how do we deal with cost shifting if we don't incorporate all payer systems into this process? So I think ideally what we were talking about is all systems, the broader healthcare system. Is it? I'd be interested in others' reactions. Glenn.
No, yeah, I absolutely agree. In any type, and I think if you look at the overall reform movement, what we're trying to do in all these committees, it's definitely the whole system. It isn't just the public system. So absolutely, it has to be all payers.
And Jan?
Yeah, I think, again, to kind of quote Dale from an earlier meeting, and I appreciate it in one of the documents here, even the notion of private coverage being in quotes, because the notion of what's private and what's public deserves further examination given all the public dollars that are in the so-called private insurance, given tax policy and public payment for medical education and research and all of, I mean, the whole notion of private market is a little disingenuous to some in some degree. But from the standpoint of, and this may be where we may want to talk about whether we want to recommend a longer-term, bigger picture discussion, you know, at the, you know, kind of to pursue the wildest dream scenario, if you were going to try to maximally leverage all the public dollars in the whole system, mm-hmm. writ large, that would take you down a road that's equally complex to the single payer discussions and other things, and well beyond our scope in a short time frame here. But I kind of thought that's what we were perhaps alluding to in talking about, you know, really lofty design ideas, trying to get very concrete in the short term, but saying if you really want to talk about how to get maximum bang for the buck across all these separate sectors and payer sources, that's a longer conversation. Todd?
If we had a logic model, the Pete Drucker model, you would have short-term goals, intermediate and long-term. And I heard Jan talking particularly about the long-term. I always hear from the electeds the short-term. You know, what can we do for the MA budget? So that's where I think I got confused, Patty, was like, I first thought we were talking about the MA budget and what we could do in the next biennium. But there is a way of laying it out. And that was actually, foreshadowing one of my comments for our deliverables is some kind of a roadmap with short-term and intermediate goals, so we don't lose track of what we're working on. Short-term, intermediate, and long-term.
And there's one of the subgroups is an insurance reform subgroup, so there may be an opportunity there to articulate what we think might be a part of their planning process. Mike, go ahead. Oh, we were going around. I'm sorry, Joan, could you have?
Great. Well, I just want to concur totally with what Patty just said. I think after last week's meeting, I had a brief conversation with you, Senator, regarding just that. You know, I'm a good example of that. You know, total private pay, but totally with John's example, you know, really at risk of becoming John's example from last week. So, you know, at some point, you will be paying for me if I need those services, but I have to spend down to get there. So I think we, you know, we all really, whether we know we've got something, you know, some sort of a disability or not, we're all at risk. And so I think we're, you know, we need to seriously be looking at this as well as the MA side of it. So, and just in thinking here, not, I know we had talked briefly about housing. I don't know if in the transition area, if that would be a good spot to talk about housing at all right in there, since that seems to be something we keep throwing around but not quite knowing what to do with it. So just when it talks about transition planning. Anyway, just something to throw out for consideration.
Okay, thank you, Joan. And Mike, were you?
Yeah, I'd like to something in here on the on my comment earlier about deferring costs. If it's going to be in the recommendations to other work group, I think there should be a base here, as you were indicating earlier, Mike. I think it might be on page 3 under the change payment incentives. There's something here already on focusing on prevention, earlier intervention. The second bullet under that, we could, for example, in the very last line, talk about the models result in higher quality care at a lower cost at an earlier stage and fewer services. So the focus is there's an incentive for paying early at a lower cost rather than paying late, probably cautioning that with something about the proven prevention methods or early intervention methods that have some proven effectiveness.
Thank you, Mike. Okay, we can go for another round. If there's someone that has another comment to make, were you going to speak, Bob?
No.
Todd?
I'll save it. No one next.
Anybody? Maybe we picked up our. Okay, then we can move to our third.
Madam Chair,
excuse me.
I would have one additional comment on the third page under consumer directed. The way it's worded here, it's largely focused on consumers who are well able to make informed decisions on their own part, and I think we should recognize that some of the individuals will not be fully able to make informed decisions on their own part. These would be people with limited intellectual ability, people with developmental disabilities or related conditions, for example, or some of the very frail elderly. And I think at least those should be recognized so that as we talk about consumer choice, it be within ability and whatever parameters.
It's where a navigator can really become helpful to the
very
person.
Much so.
Senator?
Yes,
just
excuse
one
me.
Other thing, Senator. Gail, under the high-quality, competent health care providers and care coordinators, I wonder if we shouldn't include the earlier comment that Gail made about scope of practice and how that applies in this section. Since we have it in the work group recommendations, I think it's also a design principle.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
Just one point on that last page on changing payment incentives. I think we also want to make sure that what we're not doing is making it difficult for people who need the highest level of care to find anyone. And sometimes when we start, you know, messing around with payment incentives that have to produce outcomes, someone with, for instance, a serious, you know, schizophrenia, no one wants to take them as a patient. So I think we just need to be careful when we fool around with incentives.
You know, this to me, with just a beginning struggle with all the things that many of you work with a great deal, what you're talking about is what is hard for me to visualize with this shift, that the movement towards the various silos was a protection in a sense, I think, that there wasn't parity, that in order to make certain that those with the most disability do not get abandoned in order to have more the dollars, you know, that Bob talks about that are come to the county that they're managing and they can serve more people if each of those people is just a little less, and all of those dynamics create an incentive to be
prescriptive about how money can be spent and creates all this complexity then in the decision making. So how do we avoid falling off that ledge in the process of achieving what it is we're trying to accomplish? It'd be interesting to see what we come up with. Go ahead, Jen.
That's such a great and important point. And ever the optimist, I would hope that we could say, when we talk about changing incentives, we need to reverse the incentives to the degree where the providers have the ability to be really rewarded for doing the toughest services. You know, to say we don't, you know, and this is where it gets politically very difficult to talk about redistribution and say instead of the highest profit margins being on the easiest to do stuff that happens to be high technology, but it's routine and high volume, we need to flip that so that the you know, not to be afraid of profit incentives or reward incentives, to say that people doing the toughest to serve populations should have the highest margins in the system. That's completely opposite of what it is today. But when I think about incentives, I think about, and the phrase here, amount of payment, you know, is key, not just, you know, pay me, you know, through this method, not that method. It's also the absolute amount of resource needed to make sure that that supply and that competency is there.
And then the incentives for the private pay system to support services that retain health or maintain health instead of moving away from supporting those services because they've moved to a certain level of wellness and there's not going to be improvement. So there's an extraction, whether it's private or public, I suppose there's extraction from like physical therapy services is the one I always use because I see that in the nursing homes all the time. The people are taken off of maintenance services, so they become weaker and they become more immobile and they fall, and it creates all of the high costs. So this is a complex issue. All right, for this, I'll start with Patty, and then we'll go to Gail.
The only concern I have is now is probably the order of this and the sense that when you talk about smooth transitions in a seamless system that we're making vanilla pudding. And I want to make, and I maybe it's as easy as adding an S after system to recognize that we may have to do a couple of versions in different parts of the state, that one size doesn't fit all when we're looking at especially some of the complex cares that are needed in certain communities. And you tie that to the access issue, and you tie that to the support system issue. I don't think we have a one-size-fits-all, especially when we look at the populations that many of us serve, that you're going to have a multitude of choices. So I would hope that we'd bring up to the top the consumer-directed aspect and bring the concept out that we may have more than one systems that we're talking about here, not just one.
I'd be interested in, we'll talk more about that, because I'm sort of thinking about the flexibility. How do we increase flexibility without losing that which protects? And so we reward care of the people that typically everybody wants to get rid of because it's such expensive cost, and allows the consumer choice, and also allows the systems like the county systems and the state systems some flexibility in how they create a program for a consumer.
You want to support make, the current comments. Mine are on a different direction, and it's in the same section, change payment incentives. And this goes back to one of Todd's earlier comments about where are things on consumer incentives. And I'm not reading in here anything that captures the value of assuring that we have incentives in place for the individual, the family, and the community to provide and support the individual. Sometimes we require, and we've heard it in our discussions, for people to wait and spend down until they're in poverty, until they get anything. And I think we should develop a system that we have incentives for people to support what they can without requiring that they become impoverished before they get any help or support.
Thank you. Yes, Gita.
I'm glad Pam's here because my question, I think, has to go to her. Where we talk in here about integration of the systems or the programs, I am really struck with MINDO, where there are separate pots of money, and when we are trying to submit something to the federal government, they won't allow us to put something in that's really a Medicaid benefit into the federal pool if there's extra dollars. So to talk about true integration and think about it, I think we may need a change from the federal government in how plans are allowed to operate. But, Pam, is that a correct understanding?
I think to get where you want to go to.
For example, we wanted to do something in the MINDO program for fitness and do something like what we're doing in our Medicare Advantage Senior Program, and they absolutely turned down all but the grips for the tub thing that we were putting in there because they said it was a Medicaid benefit and not a Medicare benefit. Well, when you can't be flexible between those silos, you really can't do some of the good things that we've been talking about.
Are ever states ever pilot projects? Pam?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are three states that had what we call these dual eligible demonstrations that preceded this new SNP world that we're in now with the special needs plans. We all have had the same challenges. We had to still follow the Medicare rules even back then. But when all the changes came in with Medicare Advantage and the MMA, the Medicare Modernization Act, there were more restrictions put on what Medicare could do, and that has narrowed the ability for some of that flexibility that Gita is talking about. So Medicare has basically taken the stance that that there are certain, well, they don't say that you can't replace a Medicaid benefit. You can overlap a Medicaid benefit. We, of course, would have to take that out of our Medicaid benefits then if they paid for it under Medicare. So it isn't just a rule that they couldn't help us save money. They could provide what is normally a Medicaid benefit if that was the choice. Now, that isn't maybe the best use of the system if we have to just back it out of the other side. So, you know, we're looking at other ways to find savings. The feds have allowed a little bit more flexibility there after some discussions that we've had with them where they are starting to look a little bit further at their criteria. If a plan is working closely with a state, and that's in just a few parts of the country, there's plans that are working closely with states like we are here, then they're more likely to have a little bit of a broader perspective, I think, is what they've said to us about what services they can allow under Medicare. But it's still fairly arbitrary. I think that there's not a real strong policy at CMS about this at this point.
Thank you. On this document, we can move to the next, if you're ready, the final document. This is the deliverables document.
This is the hospital work group.
Okay, we can use the same process if you want to just go around the circle. We can start over there with Mike this time, if you're ready. If not, we can... I hated that when they did that to me in school. I was always the one that they asked first.
I'll take a pass.
Okay. Anybody ready? Anybody ready to wants to speak that? Joan says no. Patty?
The only thing I would add is probably expanding number three as a starting point. Again, going back to not saying healthcare system, when we spent a lot of time again talking about the supportive services. So I think if we're going to map the different things, we have to map the housing finance agency programs. We have, you know, for affordable housing, we have to map. So it's a bigger map.
That'll be a big piece of paper.
Exactly.
Anyone else? Yes, Todd.
A couple things on page 2 or number 7, I could maybe if make the pitch that on improving prevention, there's a report going to the Public Health Committee about prevention and chronic illness. So there's a work group that came out of legislative language. And I think that's coming in next week. So there's there. And the shortcut is that for if this legislature would fund a comprehensive prevention program at the cost of one happy meal per person per year in Minnesota, we think we could affect some of the things that contribute to that. Second is on earlier intervention. I don't have to add anything, but Jan, I thought you were a champion of that in our first meeting. And it would be really helpful, Mike, if we could track something down on earlier intervention. And that's a toughie. I mean, that's a tough one, I think. But that, to me, is a thing that's not been explored. And then my actual comment was on number 8. I want to put my pitch in for the Options 2 report, page 19, which has I don't know how many recommendations on housing. So low-hanging fruit is housing, Patty's point. And it doesn't come out of the MA budget, usually. In other words, the housing that's not associated with nursing homes. I mean, one of the things that bugs us is if you're in a nursing home, the housing's covered by MA. But if you go to the community, Medicaid doesn't cover it. But there are many recommendations on housing, which are so important. And particularly in options, too, it's around people who are lower income, but not necessarily on MA. And then last, Mike, for Mike Scandrett, again, this on number 8, this issue of where would we be in 1, 2, or 5, you know, somehow try to nail down what would be measures of progress.
Great, short, medium, and long term.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Madam Chair, in the area of cost savings, I was wondering if administrative efficiencies would fit in there. We've heard today in some of the presentations, like having one assessment tool that could be used. Are there state statutes that are antiquated that are requiring things that we're doing that if they were eliminated, we could achieve some efficiencies? I think we could all name some. And I didn't see another place where it would fit.
Boy, that'd be great. Is there a list of those antiquated regulations someplace? Is there?
Well, I think we could all think of some. Yeah.
Well, let's think of them.
That'd be good homework for next time.
I mean, that's
time.
A short-term thing.
Right.
Representative Hosh can just get that done next session, right? Get rid of those?
Yes, one other Todd. Thing on ongoing work, number 9.
Todd, then Jan, we'll just move around the circle here.
Did you want Jan?
No, I'll start over there. Bob,
on ongoing work, again, this back on Gita's thing about federal regulations and the box and when was the MSHO. But again, to me, the simple vision is that we would say, particularly to people, adults or in medical assistance who are disabled, do you want $100 of service or $80 of cash in cash? I know that's very simplistic thinking, but there is a subset of the 20,000 adults in Hennepin County who are on medical assistance because they're disabled who, if you gave them cash, would purchase better than any navigator. So they don't need life by case management. Now, that's thinking way, I was pushing Alex a little bit to say, think beyond personal care and say, you have a package of benefits and we're not going to give you 100%, we're going to give you less. That's way out there. It's probably too far in an since we're all incrementalists. But I think there's a way to get there and save money and give people control. I talked last week with a woman who was in that program in Hennepin, and she didn't need integration and all that. She said, I can manage the care of my adult daughter who lives with me who has developmental disabilities. Now, I don't know if that's 5% of the 20,000 people or 55%, but there has to be a way to give people more power and save money.
Glenn, I don't see Glenn. Jan, him.
I wondered under number 4, the successful micromodels, if folks could just surface an email or something, any of their sort of implementation experiences or suggestions on ways to improve. I think after last meeting where we heard all these encouraging things about the new models, some of the hallway conversation was, yeah, but it isn't that good in real life. So I'm hoping we can gather up some of those practical examples where, from a practitioner perspective, we could offer up the next generation of improvements to these promising models. I don't know if we're going to dig deeper for that or if that's up to us as work group members to offer something up here.
So you're suggesting a homework assignment here of asking people to think about real-life practical new models that
have some outcome.
Right. Or, implementation experiences with these really promising things. That if they were going to, somebody else said earlier, go to scale or become a model, not just a demonstration, but a model, what would we have to incorporate from our experiences with these pilots?
I don't know if we've been able to compile a list of those things from our testimony, really, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
I don't know. We've got that.
Right.
And I think just sort of throwing it out, would people just sort of send things in, will make that happen, Jan? I'm just trying to figure out another. Because I think it's a good idea.
I have a question regarding that.
Yes.
The micro model, would that be, you know, right at the local level, an anecdotal what happened to a specific person, or are we talking bigger systems integration? Because in Kanabec County, I would have some examples at the community level of micro models, such as our emergency mental health team that goes out, and the coordination between the providers, emergency rooms, the EMS system, and this 18-team emergency mental health team that goes out and does an assessment right at the emergency to determine if we could put this person in community-based services.
Is this the Grand Rapids
services
model?
With housing, or, you know, if emergency room is really the place that that person should be going to. So that would be my one micro model, but I don't know if that's what you're looking for.
Well, I think we can, just like short-term, long-term, intermediary, we can talk about those things that can be done at that level and then system-wide as well. I'd accept all suggestions. Yes. Glenn, we'll just keep moving up the table here, Glenn.
Madam Chair, there's a committee that has been put together by health plans and counties. It's actually through MAXA, where we have identified areas, at least between counties and health plans, where implementation of MSHO is an example. We're really looking towards the special need plans. What hasn't worked so well? What do we need to do? So we do have a listing of suggestions about what do we need to improve going forward from our experience. So we can supply that.
That's when there's a county health and private health plan partnership that collaborates those resources.
Correct.
Yes, Sue.
I think it would be helpful to really kind of delineate what's required by the feds in terms of, you know, Medicaid, and what we can really do under Minnesota Care, especially if you're not, you know, there's no SCHIP funding there. And an example would be, you know, you can't use Medicaid dollars in public institutions. So, you know, institutes for mental disease, jails, you know, that type of thing. But you can run into a situation where you have someone, take a person who, you know, has a serious mental illness, they're on Minnesota Care, there's no SCHIP funds, no federal funds involved. It's a managed care plan. The state's prepaid those dollars. They go into jail, and now the county's paying for medications while the person's in jail. You know, and so you have kind of a double payment going on there. But we could set it up. I mean, we could say that we're going to use Minnesota Care dollars that are strictly state dollars to pay for that mental health treatment that that person requires while they're in jail. There's nothing except our own state statutes that prevent us from doing that. And so in a way, we're double paying in some respects. Plus, if the person's in there for longer than 30 days, we're making them, you know, reapply. And so you have a real broken down, you know, system in terms of when someone leaves, they're not, you know, they don't have their insurance anymore, and then they're falling through the cracks, and then they might end up back in. And so when we talk about the fragmentation and cost shifting, we really have to think about how that happens, where people lose their benefits, you know, and it takes a while to get back on. And I think we could save a lot of money, frankly, by looking at that particular set of systems, if that made sense.
It did, and I think that
when I think about that, cost shifting in that situation is not really healthcare or tax savings, because it's moving from one tax system to another. And then we start talking about how do counties pay for those systems is a very...
Right. And, I mean, Hennepin County has said, you know, well, we know that you're not going to pay us for the medications, but it would be cheaper for us to put someone in a car and drive down to the Walgreens on Lake Street to pick up the medications for the people in the jail. I mean, that would be cheaper for them to do that than to keep paying for it out of pocket, basically.
Okay, Gail, you had a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, to the question of how we zero in on the next generation of improvements over the promising for the promising programs we have in place, I wondered if we could. It's just an idea to throw out. If we took a question that was asked of the panel, I think last week, which was Jan, I think you asked it. If you could wave a magic wand, what one thing would you change? If we had a panel that had a provider, a consumer, a payer, a purchaser involved with these promising programs, and that was the question to them. If you could wave a magic wand and change one thing that would improve this program from your perspective, what would it be? I don't know if, I mean, we could certainly gather some provider information from our organization as a homework assignment and bring in emails, but I think, again, on the theme of integration, we need to understand from all of the perspectives what might advance these programs beyond where they are today, either in scale or in depth or in cost savings.
And we may not be able to gather that data, you know, as you're saying, but it certainly
well, it
suggests
like
that there's an ongoing process and study that needs to occur here. We won't be able in the time we have to make all of the suggestions and changes that are possible.
So maybe that's part of ongoing work, but it sounded, Glenn sounded like he has some information mm-hmm. along those lines already. I don't know if it's at a stage that could be easily assimilated by us in the time frame we have.
No, and we would want that information. We can include that in our, that it's partial. It's not complete. This will be incomplete. Unless you know of a way for us to quickly gather more information.
A panel is what came to mind for me, but obviously that's sort of skimming the surface of what might be there.
But we might that might be an idea. We could do a panel. Okay. Patty? Our time is like 2 minutes before we're going to conclude our meeting today. So, Patty,
just
I'll
just two
you.
Words.
Okay.
Could you text message us those words?
When you do Todd's stages of goals, the federal waivers needed should be in the, you know, because we know that that's going to be one of the issues. I'd also like to add in the word technology under number four. I think there's a component of micromodels using technology that we may want to have people think about, and that mm-hmm. word's missing.
Okay, where will we be going from here? We're going to retreat now with the information that we've gathered here. You also have homework assignments, some of you for, all of you for examples. We would like to get some examples for, especially to help people understand what we mean by cost shifting. And also some of you who serve on other committees will email us about specific suggestions we might make in our report to the work groups about things they might consider in their work, in their final report. We had some suggestions that we hear from another consumer group or a provider group, and also from county-based purchasing. Do we need to have more testimony of that sort, do you think? Or have we picked up enough of the themes? Is there any other presentations that people think we ought to be having besides the one Gail talked about?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I could talk about the integration care coordination model that South Country Health Alliance implements. just briefly?
It would be what we've been asking in the presentations, just to highlight those things. What was the integration goal? What were the barriers, and what did you do to overcome those that are applicable kinds of generalized ideas for meeting the goal of this committee? So we could do that. I'd like to give us enough time to go through these documents again to make sure that people have been heard and that we're. Because after that, after we do this one more time, we're going to take a look at asking some fiscal, some kind of discussion of what the fiscal implications might be about what we're talking about, so that we can meet Senator Berglund and Representative Huntley's request for some idea of what we're talking about fiscally. So I'd like to try to get to a point where they can begin that work by the end of the next meeting, which will be next Tuesday. Okay, great. Well, thank you, everyone, and we'll see you next Tuesday.